Welcome to the 122nd edition of the Gooner Podcast. This is your host, David Udo, and we're recording on the Monday evening after the 4-1 home win versus Norwich, 24 hours before Arsenal face Borussia Dortmund at home in the Champions League. So, on to the panel introductions. Firstly, he was invited to be on the panel for the opening podcast this season, but didn't fancy the sound of his own voice. However, come the night, feeling hungry, he regretted missing out on a free meal we provide for our guests. So, he's seen sense and turned up to digest a Chinese takeaway this evening. He's a long-term Gooner contributor, regular columnist on Arsenal for the Irish Examiner newspaper, and has maintained his A Gooner's Diary blog for many seasons, as well as writing a couple of books on title-winning Arsenal campaigns. It's a warm welcome back to Mr. Bernard Agelet.
Thank you for having me.
Next up, another returning sometime panellist. The cheeky scamp has even written his own intro, and I quote, regular writer and blogger for the Gooner, who always tries to maintain a confident perspective on Arsenal and fends off hype about Tottenham by attesting that each campaign is a 38-game season. Well, that's enough self-perception for this evening. One can only wonder what's next. Will he be asking his own questions for himself to answer? Wrapping up the show instead of my good self? Buying the drinks for panellists? Organising the November podcast? We will soon find out. Good evening to Mr. Simon Rose.
Good evening.
Finally, last and very much least, going by some of the comments received every time he's the temerity to post a piece online on the subject of an Arsenal match, he's a man running low on tin hats as the AKBs pipe up and pour vitriol over his every word, reading between the lines to detect anti-Wenger barbs. His only real confusion about the phenomenon is why people that don't like reading what he has to say keep coming back for more. It's a mad, 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 mad world at Online Gooner, but attempting to retain his sanity and here to offer his views once again, it's hello to the editor of the Gooner, Mr. Kevin Witcher.
Evening all.
So, gents, we recorded the previous podcast after Mesut Ozil made his debut for Arsenal. He's made a further four appearances since then against Stoke, Napoli, West Brom and Norwich. Simon, what kind of difference do you think he's making to our team?
Well, he's making a huge difference. He seems to have raised all the other players' expectations and belief in themselves. It's interesting, you know, in the summertime when we had such a poor transfer window, certainly in the early periods anyway, people thought there were several positions that had to be improved on. People said up to five, six players had to arrive. And of course, in the end, apart from the goalkeeper we haven't really yet seen, and Flamini, who many people weren't really happy to have come back, you know, Ozil was the only other signing, but his effect has been so big that I'm not entirely sure that people think we still need all these other signings. Everybody else in the team seems more confident. The midfielders believe they're going to get ball in good positions. Giroud is getting great service from the whole of midfield, as influenced by Ozil. The defence feels more confident, so they're not having to do quite as much work either. Chesney's playing really well. I thought he played well for Poland against England as well. It's quite gutting to see Rooney score against him, but suddenly we don't look as if, on the face of it, that we have as much need for so many signings come January as we did in the summer, and that's almost literally because of the influence of Ozil, what he's doing personally himself, creating goals, scoring goals, but how he's making other players feel. I mean, look at Ramsey, what he's doing is surreal.
Absolutely.
I was confident if he got fit in the summer and at a restful time, he'd be great this season. But what he's done so far is astounding.
Bernard, am I correct in saying that essentially Ozil's the best steroid anyone could imagine? Or is it bits of everything?
I think that a large impact of the Ozil effect has been psychological. It was the fact that we lost our world-class player in Van Persie, and now we've got a world-class player, £42 million player, whose every touch of the ball suggests that his value for money, and he doesn't really have to do that much. Ozil, it's the way it's lifted everyone around him, and for me, the unsung part of that equation is Flamini, because while I initially questioned whether Ozil might have a potential to be a luxury player, because the first few games I swear I didn't see him break sweat. However, I've had to I've had to definitely bite my tongue, because on Saturday you saw a lung-busting run from midfield to get into the box to score his goal with a header, and he works as hard as anyone. So, but for me, it's the Flamini effect combined with Ozil, which is suddenly, psychologically, everyone seems to have suddenly lifted their game accordingly.
Anything for you to add, Kev? Because as far as I was concerned, I mean, on the 31st of August, we were a team missing a goalkeeper or two, only one centre-forward who we'd all established was completely rubbish, and we went to spend €50 million on another creative central midfield player, not expecting it to make a difference. But something has happened, hasn't it?
Well, I think even if you've got enough players in a particular position, if you buy better, you're going to improve. I think my own view on Ozil is that when we are playing our possession game, our development of tiki-taka, if you want, it looks like a different animal now. It seems to be a bit more efficient, a bit less ponderous, and I think that's partly because it's a confidence factor and an ability thing. When Ozil does touch the ball, generally, if you compare it with a move going through Theo, you know, your percentages of it coming off dwindle. So if you've got an Ozil in there, your chances of actually making that thing happen are so much better. The irony being, we had this fantastic first goal against Norwich, in which Ozil didn't touch the ball, and yet, you know, that was the sort of one-touch football that top players of Ozil's calibre will produce. So I just think that we've become more efficient in attack through less wastage, more telling passes. I mean, Ozil is a bit like Bergkamp in that he won't always be involved. You know, he can drift out of games a little bit. Bergkamp was doing that all the time. But, you know, Bergkamp could do three things in a match that would win you the match and then be quiet the rest of the time. And there's an element of Ozil to that. I think there may even be an element whereby he is picking his games as well. Mm. You know, the difference between his display against Stoke and then 4 days later against Napoli, or 3 days later, was marked. Mm. You know, I think he really pulled the stops out in the Napoli game because it was a different level. He knew something special was needed, so he wasn't going to go at full pelt for both games, but overall I just think just a marked improvement in our attacking efficiency due to the quality of the player.
I think that's well agreed. I think I'm safe in saying that all 60,000 of us are really, really happy whenever he goes anywhere near the ball. Although I'm correct in saying there's someone who is unhappy in the ground, in the sense that when we got rid of that mid-table centre-forward who can't score at the moment, what's his name, Van Persie, that's him, he gave up his number 10 shirt. That shirt had to go to Jack Wilshere because he's going to be the centre of our attacking side of the team. He's on the number 10 for the next 15 years, he'll end up as our captain. But Simon, in what position can Jack Wilshere now expect to be played? Because let's face it, we've got a number 10 now.
I think part of the truth here is that he doesn't necessarily have to expect to be played, you know, for so long. I know personally, others as well, had concerns that he'd been overplayed, been brought back too quickly at times from injuries. We don't have to play him all the time now. There's no guarantee, no obligation. He's got to play every single game, and he shouldn't have to play every single game. You look at all successful teams, they don't play the same team every single game. Mm-hmm. They don't need to. If Ozil happens to be the guy who's going to play in that kind of central behind the striker-ish kind of area, fine. He plays a bit off to the left, fine. And you think Wilshere played on the left hand side away at West Brom recently, and there was criticism in the papers about it, and I thought, well, really, what difference does it make? He has some ropey times in the match, but he also scored a goal. And really, a young player like him who's had injury problems and probably will still have them for some time, because I think he's got a real low centre of gravity and he always looks to me like he's going to roll over on his ankles. Mm-hmm. He needs not to play all the time, so he'll find a natural position. And he might shift around, whatever that role is, for the benefit of the team. I mean, you mentioned Flamini before. Mm. People weren't happy when he came back because people thought, oh, he left us 5 years ago, what a Judas. Well, frankly, people were saying he had a rubbish time at Milan because they were rubbishing him. He played over 120 games for Milan and he won the league. Mm-hmm. And he wanted to be back with Arsenal. And look at how well he's plugged the defensive side of midfield, which is allowing the others to blossom. So Wilshere, he can play in a more attacking sense if need be, and wherever the need comes along, but he hasn't got to play all the time, which is a benefit to him.
What are you thinking, Ajoulay? Bernard, even, I address you by your first name, excuse me. Are we talking about putting him on the right-hand side so he can cut inside, on the left-hand side to get to the byline and pull it across, or does he play as one of the two?
I get the distinct sense that Jack doesn't enjoy being asked to play out on the flank, and he's not a winger because he doesn't have the pace, doesn't have that sort of pace to burn down the wing. And to me, Wilshere has always been most effective as he was on in that first goal, that amazing first goal on Saturday, going through the middle. But I think we should see the benefits with Wilshere, because when last season, it was everything was on his shoulders. If Wilshere wasn't going to create, then who was? And now there's everyone can create. And so, having been relieved of being of having that such a big burden on him, I think hopefully he will blossom if he can be found room to fit into the system that we've got so much choice in midfield.
What are you thinking, Kev? Could we turn into Barcelona, play 4-6-0, and he takes up the Fabregas role of being the person at the end of the chain, as it were?
No, I don't. I think we're going to stick with the formation we've got, which is realistically 4-2-3-1, really. You know.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Wilshere was sort of being developed to kind of play in that Fabregas role, which Ozil has now overtaken.
Mm-hmm.
And so really, I think he's on the bench for the time being. I mean, the players you'd start as the two deeper midfielders are Flamini and Ramsey for me. I think the wide players, obviously Cazorla will be one. Interesting situation when Theo is fit again. Is he the right-sided player? Because then you've got Podolski, who is a left-footed player, but very good. But having said that, Arsene's not afraid to leave him on the bench, mm-hmm. So that's probably his future determined. Oxlade-Chamberlain is another one. So lots of options. You're almost in a situation in midfield where we could do a Tottenham Hotspur and play two different teams for two, you know, different games every week. I just think we're going to see a lot of rotation. A lot of players played in the wide positions when you wouldn't think it's their natural position. And the thing about it is those three players that are behind the striker are so fluid anyway.
Mm.
You know, I mean, I know technically Wilshere starts on the left, but if you watch during the game, his heat map is probably more or less on the... You know, it's actually level with the penalty area in terms of the length of the pitch. You know, he's not holding the touchline. He's coming in, getting involved. He's switching to the other flank. That is the one thing that makes Arsenal difficult to play against at the moment, because they've got footballers who can move around, and if you're man-to-man marking, you're going to just get dragged all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where space is created and opportunities made. So I think Wilshere will get enough games. He won't always play in his favourite position, but you know that's for the benefit of Arsenal long term. Because frankly, you know, there was a huge danger of burnout for that young man, as I think there may even be still for Ramsey, which I think is part of the reason that he was not started against Norwich. And Wenger has got enough players, once everyone's fit, to be able to mix and match and give people time off, which, if we are going to have a serious assault on honours this season, we will need fresh players towards the business end of things. Obviously, everyone's worried about Giroud because we don't seem to be able to give that guy a break. But I think we might have another question about that later on.
But let's say you are Jack Wilshere, at the age of 16, you're promoted to the first team squad, given your number 19 squad number. Within 18 months, you've barely played 30 games, but you're on the front cover of the FIFA computer game. You're the centre of English football. You're doing Pepsi adverts with Leo Messi and people like that. Then you disappear for 2 years, but you're still at the front of everyone's mind, the first name everyone says. But, you know, you're losing your place in the team. People are focusing on other people. So you start smoking outside nightclubs, start peeing against walls whilst training for your country, getting into Twitter feuds with different people. Simon, are you slightly worried that his focus could be not where it's supposed to be?
The thing is, when a person is a very good footballer, we tend to add traits to them they don't actually have. We think he's a wonderful footballer and therefore he's going to know everything else. You know, he's a young guy, he's making the same kind of errors that any young person might make. Any young person has a fag somewhere, no one really cares. Jack Wilshere's pictured with one, we're supposed to all, you know, pop ourselves about it. When it comes down to it, football players used to be smoking left, right and centre before people knew about the health kind of risks. I think for him, like Kev said, and as I mentioned before, he doesn't need to play every single game. He has to think to himself, I want a career out of this.
Mm.
And if he wants to still be playing in 10, 15 years' time, he needs to calm himself down and realise, as I'm sure he is and as I'm sure he's being told, you haven't got to play every single game. You know, you look at someone like Michael Owen, who was played to death to the point where his hamstrings went and he was never really the same player again.
Mm-hmm.
And players like this, whether it's for England, Arsenal, obviously, now direct desire, but also the England national team as well. If these people want to use Wilshere for the long term, he has to be protected now. And it's why when you mentioned before, you know, when Bernard was saying, you know, would he want to play, you know, way out left? He doesn't. He kind of comes in, and when we've got the right numbers, Gibbs comes around the outside and gives that kind of width. We've actually got, in the summer we were all worried we didn't have enough players. Now we seem to have a lot of players, and that's even with Podolski and the Ox out, and Rosicky's been out a bit. We kind of seem to have like more players than we realise. Mm. It's almost only as if up front's the problem. We haven't yet had to see what Bentner can or can't do, and you remain hopeful that they are really looking clearly at who they can get in January.
What about you, Bernard? Are you, everything you're reading about Wilshere in the papers, okay, he did score the goal of the season already, and he scored a great equaliser against West Brom, but, I mean, those are the very back pages of The Sun and the Daily Mirror, but the front pages are him essentially being an arse. Are we a little bit worried that you've got Wilshere the player, but you've also got Wilshere the ego, and we hope that one doesn't overtake the other?
I think it's a constant worry with in modern football that young players are going to lose their and unable to keep their feet on the ground and lose their hunger. But ultimately, you'd hope that Wilshere, there's enough in him to want to be successful at Arsenal, and you know, with the World Cup on the horizon, he's going to get his head down and do what he has to do to the worry is these days is that a lot of young footballers seem to lose it with their first big contract, and they've made it, and that's where their hunger disappears, and we haven't seen that with Wilshere, and I hope that continues. But to add to what Stuart said, the best thing this far this season, what's bothered me for years, the problem we've had for years is you look at the Arsenal bench compared to other teams' bench. And they were reserves. We had no options. Whereas, for example, on Saturday, I was disappointed to see a start at home against Norwich with Flamini and Arteta both on the pitch. That seemed fairly negative to me. I was disappointed when we did that against Napoli. But maybe you can understand being more conservative in the Champions League. But against Norwich, I thought we could play a slightly more positive team selection. And then when Flamini had his clash of heads, I don't think there were any people too disappointed to see Ramsey coming on in his place. And so it's brilliant to be able to look at players on the bench and see the team lifted by their appearance, rather than worry about who gets injured and worry how that's going to impact on a poorer team.
Kev, it's probably just me being overly pessimistic, but this is a guy who is still the centre of everyone's attention, but slowly being overtaken by Andros Townsend at Spurs or Ross Barkley at Everton as the best young thing in English football. Let's say it gets to Christmas, he's not getting in the Arsenal team. We all know that Manchester United really want a creative midfield player to build their team around. If Arsenal get a £35 million bid in January, we'll immediately dismiss it. But Wilshere's agents, they might start stirring the pot. And if Wilshere's attitude is such that he's very, very self-focused, as his behaviour perhaps has been in the last few weeks, is that the kind of thing that would worry you?
Not at the moment. I mean, I think, in fairness, Johan Cruyff used to smoke very heavily. I suspect Wilshere's probably having 10 fags a week. I don't really think that's an issue. Peeing against a wall, God, I think we've all done it. getting into Twitter feuds, well. I mean, that's his personality in a way. Or he said something in a press conference which was picked up, and then these things snowball. It's the nature of Twitter and everything that's online, basically. So what interests me is that when he does give his post-match interviews, he does seem actually quite level-headed. I mean, he's a man of the people. He's a Jack the Lad. But I just think, obviously, the press like to blow these things up because they just need stories. I think Wenger is aware that he's got a special talent, and he's certainly aware that he needs to use him enough to keep him happy. At the same time, Wenger has to persuade the player that it is not in his interest to play every game. Because if he does want to have a decent World Cup, he don't want to be knackered. I can tell you one person who will be knackered. Giroud will be knackered for France. Giroud is the starting forward for France. He's playing in all the internationals. He's going to be in a playoff in November. He is going to be a cart horse come June in Brazil next year, and he won't do them any favours at all. So the more relaxed a season players can have that are going to appear in Brazil, the better it will serve them. So I think the improvements in other players in the squad and the arrival of Ozil has actually given Wilshere an opportunity now to effectively rebuild his career, because his form last season wasn't good. And you know, even in the earlier part of this season, it wasn't particularly outstanding. But he's starting to come back. He possibly may have even been man of the match on Saturday for some people. Although I think it went to Ramsey in the end, understandably. But I think he's in a good situation if he can just understand that he doesn't play every game. He can bide his time and be very effective. So I think he's in a good position. I think the manager's got to just make sure he's aware of it.
Well, we've spent 20 minutes talking about the glory that is Ozil and Wilshere in those roles, the Welsh Jesus, as Aaron Ramsey has been nicknamed by Arseblog. But am I correct in saying, Simon, that we've got a huge other surprise package in Mathieu Flamini, and he's become one of the first names on the team sheet, hasn't he?
Yeah, but look, he came in against Spurs and he immediately was pointing around to the other players what to do.
Yeah.
He'd been away, you know, for 5 years or whatever it has been, and it's like he'd been away for 5 seconds. He's immediately plugged the defensive aspect of the midfield. I know Wenger said many times before he doesn't really think of defensive midfielders per se anymore, but someone's got to do that kind of stuff, break up play, pass it on to the others. And to me, I didn't personally have a problem with him coming back. When he left, he could have stayed. Maybe Arsenal didn't do enough perhaps to keep him, and off he went. He came back to us in the summer, and obviously it worked out that he could come, you know, and stay with us. He fits Arsenal, and really a bottom line for me was that in the summer, if Arsenal had spent say £20 million on a defensive midfielder, say Kondogbia, people would have been delighted, immediately delighted. Thank goodness we've signed a defensive midfielder. Don't care who it is or how much, but we've signed one. What we've done, and people still would have wanted a big deal other signing, striker type, midfield type signing. Instead, we've got Flamini for nothing, who can also play the full back positions, who knows the club, who knows some of the players, who knows everything else about it, for nothing. And I felt at the time, for all people's discomfort with it, if saving that 20 odd million on him can go towards a other player, another player, then I'm fine with it. And who's to say we would definitely have bought Ozil? If we'd spent 20 odd million on somebody else. I mean, your point before just about Wilshere, to me, for so much before the last 2 months or so, he's played like a playground player. You could imagine him like a 7-year-old, he wouldn't be any different.
Yeah.
Scampering around every break time, chucking himself into every challenge. That's how he plays now. He just lobs himself into all the challenges. And at some point, regardless of whether his physique allows him to play regularly and he has these ankle problems, he needs to chill out a bit. Otherwise, he'll end up doing, he'll do a gazzle, he'll do himself in, or he'll do somebody else in. Like Kev was saying, it's manna from heaven for Wilshere that Ozil's come. It's not that he's taken his place and it's going to leave him not playing for Arsenal and open to a move elsewhere. It's going to give him the breathing space to actually rediscover Jack Wilshere.
Bernard, there's a poll on the club website at the moment as to what our best midfield partnership is. In itself, I find it quite miraculous that the people who run the club website know how we play football. But What's yours going to be? I'm not going to try and turn one way or the other, but at the moment, the result, just so I was leaving, the poll only opened this afternoon, but 54% have gone for Flamini and Ramsey.
I suppose on current form, I'd have those two as a starting pair, both because I think Arteta, as good as he is, I think after an hour of football, I see signs of fatigue in him and in Rizicki after playing more than an hour, where especially with Arteta, where he gets the wrong side and ends up having to make a foul because he doesn't seem to have the same energy level. So I think I'd definitely go with Flamini, and I think Ramsey at present, you can't leave Ramsey out. Other than that, it's perm any three from the five, I guess.
Mm. Well, I agree completely, Kev. The first two names you put in the midfield, I mean, let's face it, when it comes to Arsenal, way at Stamford Bridge, it's whether it's Flamini or Arteta, isn't it?
No, not if you're playing defensively. Okay. I mean, against Napoli, we did put those two out.
Mm-hmm.
And we put them both out against Norwich, but I suspect that was to give Ramsey a rest.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I appreciate the value Arteta has brought to the team. But when Flamini was originally signed, I thought, OK, there's another squad guy. I wasn't thinking Arteta's not going to be replaced. I was thinking we need someone better than Flamini or Arteta to play the role. Now, what has happened since has changed my mind, and Flamini has been a revelation. I think he's learned a lot in Italy. He's matured as a player. He was decent enough in 2008. It's interesting that our season collapsed a bit when two particular players got injured, which were Gallus and Flamini. Flamini limped off against Liverpool in the Champions League, and we were still actually with a shout at the title even at that stage. And we only missed out by about 4 points or something by the end of it. But Flamini didn't play the last half dozen games, I think.
Mm.
So what's happened is that effectively Flamini's become a first choice. Arteta, to me, is now on the bench to play in maybe the less important games or the games where we Flamini will be suspended. I don't know how many bookings he's had already, but he can't. He's probably going to end up getting a five, get a suspension, get another five, get a second suspension. So I basically think that Flamini and Ramsey, the people voting, are right at the moment. So you could not drop either of those players. Now, whether or not that lasts is another issue. You just can't say in football. But, if it ain't broke, then don't fix it at the moment. So, as far as I'm concerned, it'd be interesting to see what happens tomorrow evening against Dortmund.
Hear, very much so. Another point that Kev raised earlier, Simon, was with regards to Olivier Giroud, who's going to play so much by the end of the season. He's going to be a fatigué Giroud, if my terrible French makes any sense whatsoever. I mean, tired horse. So, God forbid something bad happens, he does get a bad injury, or it gets to December, he can barely stand up. Can Nicholas Bentner, the greatest striker that ever lived, as the tattoo says on his body, can he be the man to relieve Olivier Giroud when he needs a break? Do we need to buy in January? Can we rely on Yaya Sonogo, Benika Fobe, Austin Lippmann? What would you do, sir?
Well, we certainly can't rely on Sonogo if he's not fit enough to play. Bentner, all jokes aside, is a perfectly, is a good player. If his fitness is strong enough, he can have an impact. I thought he looked absolutely fine when he came on at the weekend. He was involved in play. He wasn't kind of hiding anywhere, pretending he wasn't fit enough. I think the interesting thing that leads me to believe that we almost certainly will buy a striker in January is something that Kevin partly mentioned before. Giroud, as we know, is the main striker right now. He's basically having to play all the time. He's going to play in those two World Cup qualifier matches for France. There's two more big games, travelling involved in that to Ukraine, etc. His manager's French. Wenger's obviously going to want the French national team to do well in the World Cup.
Still not qualifying.
Of course, it's not in France's interest to have Giroud so utterly knackered that he can't then help them next summer.
Mm.
You think that Wenger, even with this bit of a, the French sort of national sort of hat on, would not want to have France having their main striker just, demolished by the time that World Cup comes around. It makes me think it's just another factor that increases the likelihood we'll sign someone. And surely he's got to know. We can't just drag out Giroud for every single game. To me, I know a lot of people weren't convinced by Giroud. I thought he had a perfectly good first season. He got a lot of jip off a lot of people, including Arsenal fans. He scored a lot of goals in his first season. I mean, him and Podolski together got pretty much the same amount of goals that Van Persie got on his mm-hmm. own the season before. And even though at times looked pretty kind of cumbersome, he's now connected with his teammates much better. He's seen his runs are much more purposeful than they ever were. He seems to be running with a reason rather than just sort of galloping around like a horse. And now, of course, with those who are spraying their passes around, I mean, it must be like the best gig in the best striker gig in the world at the moment to be the Arsenal striker. Mm. But of course, you can't just leave it all to him. So I think in the meantime, yeah, Bentner's the next guy. Even just in lieu of the fact that Snogo is inexperienced and basically isn't available because he's injured,
mm-hmm.
Bentner's the guy. How much Wenger really... You'll get an idea of how much Wenger really trusts Bentner if he actually lets Bentner start a game. I mean, if it's a proper game...
Palace away on Saturday.
Game. Well, plausible. plausible.
I think I'm in goal on
if
Saturday.
We had Sunderland at home soon, say, for example, he might start a game like that.
Yeah.
Does Wenger trust him enough to let him start a game? It's okay to bring him on later on against Norwich when Norwich are basically... You know, staring into space because they're so just amazed what's happened to them.
Mm.
If he trusts Bentner with the game, he believes he's got a season in him. If he won't let him even play in matches where he could play, if Giroud's 50-50 for a game, you think he won't play but he does play, then you'll see that Wenger doesn't really rate Bentner and just happens to still have him.
Bernard, in the summer, our first two choices were Suarez and Higuain, centre-forwards. And although we've spent €50 million on Ozil, there are millions and millions of pounds to spend. That's what Gazidis keeps telling us all the time, so it must be true. If it gets to January, let's say everyone's fit. Bender's come in for a couple of games, got his goals. But what the paper's saying is true, in the sense that Karim Benzema and players like that are available. For a relatively cheap £30 million, do you think Wenger's going to go in, or will he reserve everything and give Nicholas Bentner his chance as the backup, if not more?
I'm not sure that either Higuain or Benzema would be the answer. From what I've seen of both of them at Real Madrid, they've not been the answer for Real Madrid. I think it would be an expensive gamble to see whether either of them could cut it in the Premiership. I'd love us to sign a Suarez in January. I think a lot of that will depend on what happens between now and January and whether they think it's necessary. When we signed Giroud, he never looked like he was going to be a top draw striker to me, and he's fast winning me over because his attitude and because he is getting the sort of touches. Coming to Arsenal post Van Persie was always a bit of a poison chalice. No one was going to be able to fill, or was going to struggle to fill Van Persie's 30 goal a season boots. But Giroud is fast winning me over. But then when you look at it, I think Bentner is probably a more naturally gifted player. If Bentner had the attitude of Giroud, he'd probably be a better player. And it's just depending whether Wenger and Bentner can sort himself out to play the team role that you would get from Giroud, whether he can be considered as a suitable stand-in, and unless he proves that between now and January, then they'll be forced into going out and splashing the cash. If he does prove himself, who knows, maybe they won't. I mean, January has never proved the best time for buying players, in the sense that everybody is, there's so many teams in a position where they need an answer to a problem. If we're still top of the league, we're probably less inclined to be in that position compared to people who are more desperate.
Immediately before the closing of the transfer window, Kev, a deal was done with Crystal Palace for Bentner to go there, and it was only us fucking up getting Chelsea's fourth choice centre forward to come into the squad for him. Am I safe in saying that Wenger will get by the first striker he can do in January if there's one available?
Yeah, I don't think Wenger does have faith in Bentner. I think there's too much water under the bridge. I mean, you know, Bentner, when he was playing for Arsenal, it was often said he had the first touch of a rapist, was the phrase, which is a bit unfortunate. I mean, I think that's a bit harsh, but whether Bentner fits the style of the play that Arsenal are experiencing at the moment, we'd have to wait and see. You know, he'd have to start a game and then we'd be able to tell. Giroud has certainly adapted to it. The problem with Giroud last season was that he didn't score many in the league with his feet. And more pertinently, he missed quite a few with his feet in big games. You know, he had chances that you've got to take when in those games when you might only get one. And the sort of thing that Van Persie used to actually take advantage of, Giroud wasn't. And you thought, well, is this first season syndrome or is it just that he's not actually up to the mark? Now, as Simon has said, you know, he has genuinely improved and he seems a different player this season to me because of the goals he has scored with his feet. When he scored the win against Tottenham, didn't he?
Yeah.
So, you know, so let's see what happens when we play Liverpool, we play Man United, Chelsea and Man City. Let's see if he when he gets those opportunities, he converts them. Because that's what you've got to do, you know, in the 1-0, the big games, that you get that chance, you take it. So, even so, you know, the burden on that player has to be lifted. We don't think Bentner is genuinely in Wenger's thoughts. He's obviously going to make the noises and he is going to play him in the Capital One Cup. But I don't think Bentner will start any league games. I think ideally Bentner might be starting at Napoli away in the sixth game of the Champions League because it's a formality. You know, we live in hope there. But I suspect that plans are already afoot for a significant purchase in January up front, so that the manager has genuine options, and you know, big clubs have more than one front man that they can call on. And realistically, Arsenal have one at the moment.
Man City have got four.
Well, there we are.
If we can somehow get hold of Edin Dzeko, I think we'd all be quite happy.
Look at it in sheer basic terms. No matter what clubs say, no matter what they said in the summer, you come to January, two players stand out to me. It's been perfectly gettable. Suarez and Benteke, they're not playing European football. Their clubs can say whatever they like. They can make up nothing's going to happen. But when push comes to shove, those players will want it and those clubs can't give it to them. And that's such a major thing. If we've got the money and we're looking good, and we make overtures for those players, you think those players are going to stay there? They'll be pushing, gagging to get out.
As long as we don't do a repeat of the Arshavin deal, then I'm sure we'll be quite happy. Anyway, but for the last sort of 3-4 years, the only holy talk anyone has before the season is whether it's going to be, well, the east or west side of Manchester wins the league. But I mean, for the first time since I can remember, we're in a genuine title challenge this year. I mean, Simon, what do you make of the other teams challenging us for the title? And sadly, whether we like it or not, we've got to include Spurs and Liverpool in that equation at the moment.
Well, on a basic level, I was delighted when United went for David Moyes, because in a sheer basic terms, you look at it and you think, can Moyes, has he got enough about himself to at least match what Ferguson was doing? And that's just got to be a no. I felt that in the summer. I thought, I don't see how he can maintain that. He's proven that, unfortunately, he hasn't been able to make any decent signings. They made a mess of certain efforts trying to get players that were blatantly going elsewhere. Fabregas, a player who blatantly wasn't going anywhere. And that was wonderful for us because they were wasting so much time doing that. There was talk that they were trying to get Ozil. We don't know what the chronology was there, but frankly, they didn't get him. Man City have changed their manager, therefore they've changed their squad. They've got a bunch of players, they've got a bunch of strikers, any of which you'd have. But you would never know, as a fan of them or anybody else, which two they're going to pick from 1 week to the next. So I doubt their players necessarily know who's playing. There's a certain amount of unspoken connectivity you have in a team that you must lose if you're constantly changing around and players don't know who they're playing with. That unsaid thing of, if I flick it here, he'll be there, he'll know I'm going to go there, he'll cross it over to me there. That's all kind of guesswork, surely, if you're constantly changing it around. So City, in a sense, are kind of catchable too. Chelsea, Mourinho is such a crackpot, it'll either literally make them or break them. They'll either be brilliant or ruin them this season. It's so crazy. And they've already had some pretty weird results and decisions. You know, Kevin De Bruyne, who they kind of signed 3 managers ago, was great at the start of the season. He deigned to say some mild criticism and he's been shoved into a bucket somewhere. I don't know what's happened to him. So although those clubs have got a certain sort of self-defeatist element to it at the moment. Spurs, I'm always delighted to hear them being talked of as title challengers, because they believe all the hype, and that's what kills them in the end. Mm. So Arsenal, from the awful Aston Villa situation, suddenly we've blossomed into something which is clearly special. Mm. We just don't know what legs it's got on it. And in a way, it's almost a little bit too early, this. Mm. You know, we're 8 games into a 38-game season. If this happened game 18, we were in this great run right in the middle, it'd be taking people by surprise. By the time they're getting used to Arsenal looking good, we'd be towards the last 10 games or so before you knew it. Whereas now, it's so early, we're out in the open. Everyone knows about Arsenal mm. now. And how we come through the next 10 games or so would be very interesting. Are we still in this sort of position come Christmas time? Because if we are, when then we do have a title challenge on our hands. What we don't know is if, are we at the moment just a pacemaker?
Oh, what a good shout. But within that, we spoke about Manchester United, and let's face it, this would be the third decade in a row in which they'd be close to dominating English football. But, I mean, let's face it, something's happening there. Bernard, what is happening at Manchester United?
I think football's always been cyclical. the impact of money has altered that effect, but it's still cyclical, and there was always going to be an impact of Ferguson retiring. And I think this is a perfect opportunity this season, with what's going on with all the other potential challengers, for the likes of us to do something. As Stuart says, I mean, ever since we signed Ozil, I've been wondering whether, and since we hit the top of the league, I've been wondering whether it's a bit of an illusion, and not wanting to get too excited. And after Saturday's game, you wonder, well, maybe it is true. Maybe there is something happening this season, and maybe. Maybe it is our turn to take advantage of what's going on elsewhere, where there is going to be an opportunity for if a team that can find sufficient consistency, because it looks like every other club is going to continue dropping points.
Well, which brings me the question to you, Kev, shining the light in your face. In a word, who do you see as the likely title winners at this early stage?
Chelsea.
I thought he was going to say that. I was thinking it myself. Any particular reason?
Firstly, because I put £100 on them the moment Mourinho signed for them, because that man is a results merchant,
yeah.
And that's what you need to win titles. Having said that, you know, I mean, obviously I hope I lose the money because Arsenal win the title, mm-hmm. you know. A couple of things that strike me. Firstly, about what, you know, what Simon's saying about this run. What we used to have when we were winning things was the whole thing about in the tunnel, you look at the players next to you and you think, fuck, I don't fancy playing this lot today. Mm. All right. Now, all this hype that's going on about Arsenal and how good these players are, I wonder, you know, you live in hope, but that might be having a little trickle-down effect to opposition players. Now, before we started recording, we were having our meal, we were talking about the Norwich players asking for the shirts, apparently, mm-hmm. in the tunnel before the game on Saturday. Those are players in awe of the players they're going to be facing. Now, specifically, as much as anything probably to do with Ozil, but, you know, if the idea that Giroud is becoming a top forward, you know, and the defenders don't fancy facing him, the idea that Flamini is going to blind you if, you know, you make another tackle on Wilshere does genuinely intimidate the opposition, there may be the development of possibly, and this is living in hope, that kind of feeling before the game, whereby psychologically Arsenal take the field at an advantage. And that's really what they need to establish, especially in these coming games against the bigger teams, that they can actually mix and match it with everybody, not just the guys who are in the bottom end of the table. On the other side, it is a very, very strange quirk that the first 8 matches of this season just happened to be matches we won last season. We actually took more points. I think we actually took 24 points out of the 8 fixtures we played last season on the concurrent matches, the corresponding games. We've actually taken 19 this season. So you could make an argument.
I'm doing badly.
Actually, things aren't all about the same. But that isn't reality. Obviously, momentum is everything.
Right.
And so I'm not reading much into that. But it's just a very, very strange quirk that the fixture list produced 8 matches that we happened to win last season as our first 8 games.
Okay.
But as I say, November and December will tell us so much.
Very briefly, gents, Simon, Bernard, who's going to win the league for you two?
I think these next few matches where we play some of these big sides are so crucial, because if we actually get great results from them, you go to Man United and beat them, and it's pretty obvious why we've beaten them, then suddenly we'll have seen off some of those big sides, and you know, Liverpool too. The coast is almost a bit clear for us. If we get done in those matches, we get beaten at home by Liverpool and lose, and it's all a bit wrong at United and Van Persie scores, the balloon will have had a pin stuck in it. We definitely, based on what we're doing now, we are playing like champions. This is what champions look like. This is like kind of going back in time to the Invincibles. We're kind of playing fast-paced, one-touch football, and it kind of looks easy. You look at it and you think, well, why aren't we doing this all the time? So that kind of basis, you look at that and you think that team can win the league. But it is early, and like Kev says, for me, I thought start of the season, Chelsea win the league, because United and City are in a little bit of a mess, and Mourinho, unfortunately, is such a piece, he makes his teams win. You've got to look at Chelsea. But we are revving up to spoil their party.
Bernard, tell us, what's it going to be?
This is the same Chelsea who've let Lukaku go out on loan and haven't got a decent striker. I mean, as of last season, I was the one looking at the likes of Oscar, Mata and Hazard and thinking, you know, Chelsea have got the best midfield in country, maybe potentially the best midfield in the country, possibly in Europe. And now suddenly I don't care what Chelsea are doing, because what we're playing is far better and far more players who've been together, who know each other, and there's some kind of spirit building. And when all the pundits for the last few years, all of them, they comment about, they all love to watch the Arsenal, but we've got a soft centre. And if we've finally found a way to eradicate that soft centre, and we can go and nick a win against United or nick a win against City, and we can prove ourselves worthy of being labelled potential champions, who knows? I'm not going to say Arsenal because I don't want to put the bock on us, but if you ask me again in December, I might be slightly more upset.
It's just nice. We're in a different frame of mind, whereas this time last year, we were just hoping and praying for the UEFA Cup if we were lucky. We're all in fancy dresses, Fraser from Dad's Army. Anyhow, gents, the new issue of The Gooner, out for the trip to Palace on Saturday, features a piece in the light of the Napoli game about memorable European home ties, with contributions by a number of writers. So, Simon, Kevin, no need to repeat what's in the issues, but gents, would you care to relay a memorable European home game for us? Starting with you again, actually, this time, Bernard.
Does it have to be home?
Yeah, it does.
Yes, the editor says it has to be.
And you're relying on my memory. I think you should go to somebody else first and let me get the gears.
Mr. Rose, as our other guest.
I know the issue I talk about, the FC Tun game, where we just about won through Burkamp, but... I think Paris Saint-Germain in the Cup Winners' Cup.
The semi-final that year.
1993-94 would it have been, I suppose? Or maybe the year after. Yeah, I mean, it was a difficult context. I mean, we weren't entirely sure if we were up to it. I think the first leg was away, wasn't it, in 1-1. And then I think they were singing, you know, LA, Paris Saint-Germain, and then Kevin Campbell, I think, scored. So we sang 1-0 to the Arsenal. And it was a fantastic atmosphere. It's a quite rare atmosphere to get. I know certainly at times if you draw a really, really hard looking team on paper, people think, oh my god, that's going to be such a hard game. It doesn't always end up being that way. Like matches at home to Juventus, that wasn't actually as hard in the end as it looked like it was going to be. There have been some wonderful, wonderful nights, but sometimes those nights where everyone thinks you're not going to do well, but you actually do, they just feel so fantastic.
You mentioned that game, you don't mention Ian Wright doing a late tackle on Rye or whoever it was on the left, yeah. Paris Saint-Germain, he started crying.
I remember that, yeah.
Bless him. Kevin, off the top of your head.
Well, it's not off the top of my head, I was thinking about this earlier. In the issue itself, I talked about the Barcelona 2-1 victory about 2 years ago, simply because no one else had done a game at the new stadium. And as the editor, I felt the gap had to be plugged. But actually, I'm going to talk briefly about a game that was a bit of an urban myth. because it's the round before Simon's selection when we played Torino in the quarterfinal of the Cup Winners' Cup 94.
Was that 1-0 on the course of both legs?
You know what I'm going to say. The goal was scored by Tony Adams with a diving header, and it was 0-0 in Torino, and we won 1-0 in the return. And it was a very tight tie. However, the great story about that game is that a certain person was in attendance in the Highbury crowd, and it was the Ayatollah.
Osama bin Laden.
Osama bin Laden. That's the better, right?
Al Qaeda.
Now, yes, of course. But this simply developed because the guy happened to be in London at the time, doubtless at the Finsbury Park Mosque. No question at all he was there, and because he was so close, this idea that he actually attended a football match and became an Arsenal fan somehow sprouted. Now the other thing is, there's this perverse kind of feeling that, you know, Osama bin Laden was a gooner. Should we be proud of that, you know? It's almost comical.
You can't imagine him following results from afar, particularly.
No, not really. I suspect he didn't attend the game, but it's a great story that he was at that game.
I tell you, it does an awful lot to render me speechless, but I don't really have anything to say in response to that. Bernard, top that. No pressure.
Top Osama bin Laden. I can't. None of the Emirates European nights strike me as memorable. I suppose most of my memories are away games because of going to all the away games.
You're telling me you can't remember Barcelona 2-2 one season and 2-1 the next.
Yeah. I remember the game. My memory is so bad nowadays that they all meld into
so
one.
So the more recent games have basically hit a part of your mind which isn't accessible.
Yeah, well,
I know the feeling.
Well, I mean, I've been following us home and away in Europe since about 89, and haven't missed many games over that period. And I remember some of the Wembley games were brilliant when we were playing the home games at Wembley. There's a game I remember when we were 2-0 up against the German side. Was that the Highbury or the Emirates, where we're in the first 15 minutes where it was supposed to be a difficult match?
Werder Bremen, maybe?
Yeah, possibly. Someone will tell me. I'm sure someone will tell me. Home games, home European games.
You must remember Benfica in 91.
Yeah.
I remember who scored that night. Colin Pates.
I remember the disaster against Benfica sticks in my mind more than the...
Well, you know, you can talk about bad games. They're memorable, Arsenal, European
nights. Getting beat by United 3-1.
We thought
we had a chance. We went to United in the first leg, got beat 1-0. We thought, that's not bad, that's okay. And we thought early on, yeah, we can do this. And then before we knew it, they scored two goals. We just
flattest
emasculated.
Night ever. I mean, just... Yeah. The supper of the nightmares. That was Arsenal not preparing for a game. You know, as Tony Adams said later on, the first thing you did in that match was two players take a booking for kicking lumps out of Cristiano Ronaldo. We didn't play that way. Now, if Flamini was still in the team, you've got to wonder whether or not that might have been different.
In fairness, Danielson was trying, but he was about 3 hours behind everyone else. Bernard, I won't push you anymore. Go on, last minute.
There's something about European nights at the Emirates where there's a different vibe with all the corporates. I see the corporates tromping down or up to the club, down to the club level from the upper tier for their half-time bevvies. And there's a different vibe at the Emirates. The European nights at Highbury, there was a certain special feeling to them, and I'm not sure I've sensed that at Arsenal, at our new stadium, as much as... Well, maybe it's just me being...
Hasn't happened often, but I think in those Barcelona games it did.
Yeah. Or maybe the best thing about Champions League games at the moment is it's not the Emirates Stadium, it's the Arsenal Stadium, as Emirates aren't giving UEFA any money. Almost time to wrap up, but before we do, a few more words about the next issue of the Gooner from our editor, Mr. Witcher.
Yes, it is actually going on sale at an away match, first up, which is Palace this coming weekend. We'll have two or three sellers up in the corner by the Holmesdale Road stand. Content-wise, basically, a special feature, as mentioned already, Arsenal home games in Europe, which is sort of inspired by the Napoli performance. Features on Flamini. What have you written, Simon, in this one?
Ozil.
You've written about Ozil's effect on the team, which we obviously also discussed earlier. Also, just general articles about... you know, basically the saying, Arsenal obviously has got something right by effectively changing quite a lot over the summer, especially in terms of personnel. And also a piece by someone who's noticed that Monreal Nacho, his socks weren't, there was something wrong with his socks. So this is the sort of thing where you and I are watching the game, someone else is watching what the kits look like. But you take the pleasure where you can find it. It's £2.50 and it will also be on sale for the home matches against Chelsea in the Capital One Cup, Liverpool and Marseille and Southampton. So please support us and buy the issue.
Thank you, Gaffer. Finally, the usual reminder that if you want to email us about anything related to the podcast, our address is goonapodcast@gmail.com. And with that, it's goodbye from Bernard.
Goodbye.
Simon.
Goodbye.
And Kevin.
Goodbye.
We'll be back in the latter part of November with our next podcast. Until then, this is your host, David Udo, saying thanks for listening.
La-di-da-di-da, la-di-da-di-dee, all good friends and jolly good company, way!